Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
Hello, I'm Marie Bernard. Welcome to Namaste Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today at our new time. We used to air the show live at 7 p.m. Pacific time, and now we've changed it to 1 p.m. Pacific. So thank you so much for joining us for this new time. And, of course, you can always listen to any shows you may have missed on podcast. So thanks again for joining us. And please feel free to hop into the chat room if you want to share your questions or discuss the show with other listeners. You can do that in the chat room. And if you have a question and you want to get on the air, the number to call is 1-347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. Please do make sure that you press number 1 so that it indicates that you do want to get on the air and ask a question. Today's guest is Stephen Scatini, and he is the author of The Novice, Why I Became a Buddhist Monk, Why I Quit, and What I Learned. And he had quite the adventure. He hitchhiked across Europe to India and had many adventures along the way. So I'm just going to bring him right up and have him tell us his story. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Marie. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thanks. How are you?
I'm feeling great, thank you.
Good, and I know that there are thunderstorms happening where you are right now. Are you in, where are you at?
We're in Quebec, just outside of Montreal.
Beautiful. Well,
we've had a lot of rain the last couple of days, really torrential. It's more like Florida this week, actually.
Wow, exciting.
It's a change, for sure.
So tell us how you started out. Your background is Italian Catholic.
Yeah.
And so at what age did you start to kind of rebel against the Catholic teachings?
Well, as far as my teachers were concerned, I was rebellious from the very beginning. As far as I was concerned, I was just asking questions. So in a sense, they they turned my honest questions into a sort of rebellion, and I was 18 or 20 by the time I realized there was really no place left for me in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of things were you questioning that weren't adding up for you?
Well, basic teachings that I got every day, for example, that only Catholics would be allowed into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't seem very fair to me, so I asked about all those people that God made as Muslims and Jews, and what happened to them, and didn't sound fair, and they just told me to be quiet and sit down, and you know, it was do what we say and pay attention and don't think about it, especially don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So that really put me off, because one thing they did succeed in instilling in me was a sense that that just living for this life wasn't enough, that there had to be something more. So I believed that, and I always felt that. But they didn't actually provide me with anything that seemed to lead to something more. So I went up and looked for myself.
So it sounds like in your Catholic teachings as a kid, you were really discouraged from thinking for yourself and coming to conclusions based through your own critical thinking. It was all just kind of they wanted you to regurgitate what they had taught you.
Exactly,
What did you find in the Buddhist faith? Did they encourage you to think for yourself?
Well, yeah, there was a great openness from the very beginning. In fact, I started studying with a Geshe called Geshe Ngawen Dargye, who comes from the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And their main tool of study is debate. So they're very accustomed to putting things on the block and discussing them and questioning them and trying to refute each other and using the tools of logic and reason as well as the tools of personal experience and reflection. So all my questions were completely acceptable. In fact, they were encouraged. And I was very excited about that.
And so, Stephen, when you were 18, 19, what happened for you? You were kind of finding your own path in life, and you broke out onto this hitchhiking trip. So can you tell us the story leading up to that?
Well, I wasn't actually finding my path at that time. I was losing it, really. I mean, I was trying to find it. I cut myself loose from Catholicism, which had been a relatively stable background. And, of course, it was the early 70s as well, which didn't help. And I was getting myself caught up in drugs. I actually became a kleptomaniac. I dropped out of university. In fact, I sabotaged my final exam so that I wouldn't have to end up as a middle-class drone, which is the way I saw it at that time. And I basically undermined my life to the point that I felt I had nothing left, which made it very easy for me to just get rid of everything I owned and hitchhike out of Europe towards Asia. I was actually intending at the time to leave everything behind and never come back. And I was hoping to find in India some sort of, spiritual guide or some sort of tremendous transformational experience. I didn't really know what I was going for. I certainly didn't know I was going to end up becoming a Buddhist monk. But on the way, I had all sorts of adventures, as you say, a couple of which left me almost dead. I was very lucky. I also met people who were incredibly kind to me and who literally saved my life. So that gave me a lot of faith in people and enabled me to keep looking. And when I came to the Tibetans, they welcomed me with open arms. And I felt immediately, for the first time in my life, that I had a home. And so I settled among them. It was quite easy.
So, Stephen, I'm curious, when you said that there were a couple times that you nearly died through your hitchhiking adventures or misadventures,
yeah.
What happened?
Well, the first time I got hepatitis, and I was stuck up the Swat Valley in North Pakistan. And if you've ever had hepatitis, the first thing you know about it is that it drains your energy completely. You have nothing. So I basically crawled, or I was helped by a couple of friends to the nearest hospital, which was not really something that we normally call a hospital over here. It was a shack on the side of the hill with somebody inside who called himself a doctor, and he had a few beds. And I basically recuperated there. There was no medicine at all. But I stayed in the hospital for several weeks, and then I left and went off by myself further up the valley. I was trying to get away from civilization, even from Asian civilization. I really wanted to be alone. I was on the hippie trail, and I resented all the other hippies. I really wanted to be alone. I was looking for my own path. I was very young, and at this point, I guess I wasn't very discerning. And there, as I was beginning to actually improve, get better, then I started getting involved with heroin, or with morphine. And that brought me again to a very low state. And then at that time, and it's described in the book, there was a girl that I had met in the Swat Valley who came to me, and she basically gave me a huge kick in the backside and got me out of there, out of the valley, and the next place I landed was in Dharamsala with the Tibetans.
So, Stephen, when you were using heroin, did you become addicted, or were you just dabbling in it, or what was the experience with that?
I wasn't really addicted. I wasn't doing it for long enough. She came up to see me. She heard that I was buying morphine from the local pharmacy. And she heard about it because she'd been living in the Swat Valley for years. And I'd only been there a few weeks. So she came up and she found me. She saw the needle jabs in my arm. And she screamed at me and yelled at me and basically became my mommy, I suppose. She told me off so strongly and so effectively that she woke me up to the reality of my situation. So I wasn't actually addicted, no, fortunately. So it wasn't that difficult to transition.
And so do you ever look back on that time and kind of think, I mean, thank goodness she was able to save you from yourself.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, she's a huge question mark in my life, because I don't know what happened to her. I don't know where she is. I don't even properly remember her name. In the book, I call her Anna Metta, because I know she was Danish, and that was a name that I found that I liked. But I really can't remember that. That was a hazy time in my life. And I wasn't in good shape. I was still recovering from hepatitis, which, of course, is a terrible time to start doing opiates. And my memory wasn't clear. But it was clear enough to remember what happened and to write the story.
Well, thank you for doing that and sharing it with us. And so as you left the experience of heroin behind, and then tell us what happened.
Well, then I arrived in Dharamsala, and if you've ever seen the Tibetans, you'll know that they're very colorful people, and they smile a lot. It's almost spooky how much they smile. I was a bit suspicious at first, actually. But they're very friendly, and it's genuine, or it seems to be genuine. And the culture is a sharp contrast to the Islamic culture in Pakistan and certainly the Hindu, and certainly the confusion of India. And so Dharamsala is a small hill town in the Himalayas. It was in those days quite quiet. Now it's a huge tourist mecca, I know. But in those days it was quiet. It was cool. We got away from the heat of the plains. And the food was relatively bland, so it was easy to digest. And the Tibetans had set up their government in exile. That's where the Dalai Lama lives. And they created a library, the Tibetan Library of Works and Archives, and were giving teachings to anybody who was interested. And that's what caught my attention. I started going to the daily Dharma classes, and I learned about Buddhism, the basics about Buddhism, about the two truths, about conventional truth and ultimate truth, and the four truths, the four noble truths, the Eightfold Path. I learned all this stuff for the first time. And it wasn't just in an abstract context. It was from teachers who'd been immersed in it their whole life, who'd been debating it for their whole life. And I was the other people in the class were mostly Westerners, and everybody was taking it very seriously and really trying to put it into action and live it and make a meditative lifestyle from it. And this was exactly the sort of therapy I needed. And it also went along with the dreams I had before I even left England in the first place, which is that I was looking for something even though I didn't know what. And this seemed to answer my questions, or at least to provide a forum in which my questions might eventually be answered.
And so what, I'm curious, what kind of questions, I mean, I know you originally you had questions like why do, you know, how could it be that only one religion would be the chosen people who would go to heaven, but what other kind of questions did you have?
Well, the big questions like, is there a God? And I can believe in it, but how does that really help? How does belief really change my life? How do I escape from the simple trajectory of being born and aging and dying? What's the point? You know, I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? What's the point? And when we turn to some sort of spiritual life, that's the question we're all motivated for in the first place.
So,
and
Stephen, in
underlying
your...
that, of course, is the fear of death. We all know we're going to die, and even if we accept the fact that we are going to die, we at least want it to count. We want our life to be worth something, not just the accumulation of stuff.
So, Stephen, in your opinion, and I know that nobody really, none of us really know the answer, but in your opinion, what is the point to this life?
Well, like you say, no one knows the answer. The problem is, I came to see it, and it took me a long time to understand it. The problem is the way in which we pose the question as if it's a rational question, and it should have a rational answer, that all we need is a few words or a couple of beliefs, and everything will be solved. And that is the way that most religions operate, and that is the thing that most people accept. But it doesn't really satisfy. And I came to understand the point of what the Buddha was talking about, which is that we have to depend on our own experience, our direct experience, especially the experience of the present moment, in which we can get past all the rationalizations which we use to justify our existence and explain our emotions, and simply inhabit the reality of what we are. And that way we open up a completely new dimension of ourselves. And that is, you might call it the true self. In Buddhism, it's called no self. But again, it doesn't really matter, because it's not a question of words. It's a question of experience. And I learned how to open myself to that sort of experience and to begin changing my life.
And so, Stephen, I know that through your journeys, I would imagine that with your Catholic background, you had a belief in God, and that probably changed and evolved over the course of your life so far. And now, would you consider yourself agnostic?
Yeah, I think that's the best term. If I think about God, or if I talk about God in any way, it would sort of be the same way as, say, Albert Einstein, that there is a logos in the universe. There is something which keeps laws of cause and effect running. There's a unity out there somehow. But I certainly wouldn't think of it as a person or as an individual who has particular intention for me or you to be good or bad. God is something I can't really personally relate to, but it's something that sometimes I find useful as a way of talking, for sure. Because I do believe in cause and effect. I do believe that the universe, the material universe as well as the mental universe, our actions and our behavior is governed by cause and effect. And that's why we suffer. And that's why we can avoid. That's why we can change the way in which we suffer. Because there is cause and effect. So you could call that God. I don't usually, though.
So what do you think I hear you saying that there's something out there, there's some kind of force or energy, but it's not this person.
Oh, I don't think it's a personal energy, and I don't think it has any intention to help us or harm us. I think the universe is indifferent, to be honest. But we are, human beings are the ones who created reason, and we seek reason in the universe, and we can find it if we follow our own path. We have to take the opportunities that come and use them to try and find what we're looking for. But a lot of what we find is just an explanation. And the whole point is to let go of explanations and find the simple reality of being alive, which is something extraordinary. It's something we take so much and so easily for granted, just to be alive. And yet it's something extraordinary. We have consciousness. We know what's going on. We're able to know this moment. And we won't know it for long. Life is very short. It's very brief. It's miraculous, and it's the most wonderful thing we can conceive of. And we have it, and so we should live it.
So, Stephen, I'm hearing what you're saying about appreciating this moment and not living for some other time after death or the future. But do you think that there is some kind of afterlife? What is your belief or hope in that area?
I really don't know. I don't know. I used to say I did. And in the process of asking and questioning myself, I came to the realization that, well, I believed in reincarnation and the afterlife because I really wanted to. And I realized that wanting to believe in something is not a good motivation. In fact, it's sort of fraudulent. So I changed my mind in the sense that not that I no longer believe in it, but I told myself and I realized that I don't know. I don't know if there's another life. And I'm not sure it's really important. The important thing is to live life to the full, to find integrity, to develop it. And if there's another life, then I'll enter it on a good footing. And if there isn't, well, then I wouldn't have missed anything in this life.
Wonderful point. And so we are speaking with Stephen Scatini. He is the author of The Novice, Why I Became a Buddhist Monk, Why I Quit, and What I Learned. If you want to get on the air and ask a question, the number is 347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. Or you can pop into the chat room and ask a question. I can pass this on to Stephen. And Stephen, where is the best place for people to contact you and find your book?
Well, there's a special website for the book itself. It's called thenovice.ca, thenovice.ca. And you can go there and you can actually read the first chapter and the opening pages of the book. And you can read all about it, see reviews and so on. And it links to various websites and places that you can buy it.
Wonderful. And I also, I put up a link to your website. Is it Scatini.com?
Scatini.com, yeah. That's a much bigger website. It's much. It's my personal website, and on there I've got a lot of outtakes from the book because the book took me a long time to write. It was really heart-wrenching, and the first draft ended up being 900 pages long, which is a little too much to publish. So we took out a lot of the stories. But my favorite stories, which ended up on the cutting room floor, I put into the personal website as standalone stories, so you can read them there.
How about you share some of your stories with us that didn't make it into the book? I can imagine that. I mean, 900 pages is probably just the beginning of what you could have written about your experiences.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of stuff. I basically sat down and I wrote everything that I could remember. Some of them are really off topic. In fact, a lot of people expected the book to be all about Buddhism, and it's not. As you know, if you've read it, I start out in my childhood when I was a Catholic, and it's also why I became a Buddhist monk. In other words, why I didn't stick with what I was given as a child. So there are stories from my youth. There's stories from a time when I was working, herding cattle in Gloucestershire, where I grew up in the west of England. And that's a funny story, but not terribly pertinent to spiritual talk radio, I guess.
There were no spiritual insights while you were herding cattle?
Not really. It's the story of one day when I almost got run down by a bull.
Oh my goodness.
I managed to leap over a fence. It's just something that I enjoyed writing. But there are other things in there. There are articles as well. There are discussions of the experiences I had with the Tibetans. Tibetan Buddhism is very colorful. It's much more ritualistic, and let's say we could even say it's much more Catholic than most other forms of Buddhism. And there's a great emphasis on tantra and exotic rituals. And so there's also some stories in there of how I attended my first tantric initiations and how I dealt with the teacher and how I dealt with the sense of what I was doing and trying to understand it. And I realized at one point as I was going into this that, my God, this is sort of like the Catholic Church again. I'm being expected to follow these rituals without understanding them, being delivered in a language which I didn't understand because I didn't speak Tibetan at that time. I only learned it later. And it's based on belief in invisible spirits that I'll never see. And it involves transforming myself into something that I can't really conceive of. So it brought up a lot of questions for me. And the story just echoes those questions. The whole book, as well as the website, scatini.com, is all about how we tend to just accept what we're given. And we don't question. And my whole attempt in my life and the way in which the book is written and the way in which these stories are written is to highlight the way in which I did ask these questions. And people relate to that. That's why I tell them. People understand that, some people understand that you simply can't accept what you're given, or if you do, it's not really going to have much value. If we really want to pursue truth, we have to pursue it for ourselves. If we really want to find answers, they have to be our answers. They have to be the result of our own sweat. They can't just be handed over with words or with rituals. And that's the point of all these stories.
Well, Stephen, we have a question in the chat room. Bobby Sissy wants to know about why you were in the Tibetan refugee camp.
Why I was in a Tibetan refugee camp? Well, at that time, all the Tibetans that had left India were basically living in India. They'd been given various places to stay, and they were refugee camps. Where I stayed in the south of India, in Sira Monastery, that was a large tract of jungle which was given to the Tibetans on condition they clear it, and then they made their own settlements there. And they started out as refugee camps. Right now, if you were to go down there, you would never call them that. They're incredibly wealthy, very prosperous, huge. They're huge monasteries and settlements. The Tibetans do very, very well in exile, actually. It's quite interesting. But I stayed there because that was the only place in which I could be in contact with Tibetans. It was not possible to go into Tibet at that time. And the very best of the Tibetan teachers had left and were in India in these refugee camps, and that's where they were teaching from.
And so, Stephen, you mentioned how the book is about questioning and why people accept just what they're told to believe. And I'm wondering, why do you think so many people, because it really is just a few of us, perhaps more and more these days, but it really hasn't been the majority of people questioning the teachings of these religions. They've just sort of taken them as what they've been told and indoctrinated and haven't had it ingrained in them. And I'm wondering, why do you think so many people just blindly follow what they're being told?
Well, this is a bit of a paradox, isn't it? I mean, the short answer is because people are lazy. But of course, if you're one of those people, if we're trying to improve our lives and if we're trying to be spiritual and we're trying to be, you know, religious, if you like the word, then we're also trying to be kind and we want to be nice to people. So we don't want to go around saying that the vast majority of people are lazy and that it's only a precious few of us who are really getting it. But that does seem to be the situation that we keep coming back to, that most people don't. Most people think that people like you and me, in that case, is that we should be getting on with our lives and making money and building a fortune and you know, in some cultures, having lots and lots of children, and that this is the point of life. And don't ask any questions because it just makes things more complicated. But laziness, I think, is a big part of it. Another big part of it is denial. Because people know that there are questions underneath. And I think subconsciously they know that those questions always, if you start asking them, if you kick over the first domino, then eventually you get to the bottom one, which is, I'm going to die. How am I going to handle that? What does that mean, that my life is finite? And most people don't want to face that question. Some people will rationalize it, and they'll say, well, it doesn't really have an answer. You know, you can believe whatever you want, but you never really get a real answer. There's no point in asking it. But then there are people who just are terrified of it. They just don't want to even pretend that they will die. They know they will. If you ask them, they'll say yes, but they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to think about it. They think that that is a life of less suffering. And I'm of exactly the opposite opinion, and I suspect that you are, and I suspect that most of your listeners are too.
So, Stephen, I see that we have a caller on the line, and I will be getting to you from area code 225, just one second.
Okay.
But I want to ask about, could it possibly be fear? I mean, I know that you were questioning when you were a child, and so many children do. I mean, I remember asking, well, you know, if God created everything, who created God, and questions like that that could never be answered. But at some stage, I mean, I think all children question those things. Why do you think at some stage most people stop questioning?
Well, I think what you said is right. It's fear. As children, we tend to feel safe. We have protectors. Most of us have our parents. We feel that the world out there is somehow certain and safe and secure, and we just haven't gotten it yet. But when we turn around and we look in the mirror and we realize, oh my God, I'm 25 or I'm 35 or I'm 50, and you're looking in the mirror and you think, well, my God, those questions are still there and they're still not answered, and life seems just as uncertain as ever, if not more. And that scares the pants off people. By this time also, you know, as you get older, we all develop habits. And if you've started out with the habit of suppressing those difficult questions, pushing them out of sight, then by this time they'll be very hard to access. And we have all sorts of mechanisms to get around them. And because human beings are creatures of habit. And we get into the habit of denial. And most denials are relatively small, but they have huge consequences, just avoiding the reality of our life. You know, sometimes you hear about people who are so afraid of doctors that they won't go for a perfectly conventional test. And then one day they discover that they're mortally ill from something that could easily have been prevented if only they'd gone for a regular checkup every few months. People are like that. It's very sad. It's tragic that people are like that.
So, Stephen, we talk about fear, and I think it's fear of the unknown, and none of us know what's going to happen, and it sounds like you're pretty certain about living life to the fullest right now and being in the present moment, but I'm curious, do you have fears and concerns about what may happen?
Well, yes, of course I do, but fears are transitory. They pass. So when a fear comes, you can experience it, but you don't have to inhabit it. You don't have to drag it around with you wherever you go. Then it just becomes baggage and it becomes a neurosis. So sometimes I wake up when I go out to face my day, and the fact that I don't know anything seems like a wonderful adventure. I have no idea what's going to happen. And other times it seems like a great somber threat. And that's fine. These are the sort of moods and aspects of life that we pass through. And the point is to accept them as moods and as states of mind, not hang on to them, not identify with them, but simply experience them and go on to the next moment and the next day. That, to me, is basic sanity.
Definitely. Well, thank you for that. And it is time to take a call now. So if you want to get on the air and ask Stephen a question, the number is 1-347-202-0129. And, I do see some questions in the chat room as well. I'll get to those in a minute. But first of all, we have someone from area code 225. You're on the air. What's your question? Hello?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, hi. What's your question?
Hi, I'm getting a little feedback of the program itself for some reason, so hopefully it's not coming over to you.
Yeah,
I want to talk with him
computer.
About the things. Is it clear now? That's better.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, Stephen, I can.
I can hear you,
yeah.
Can you turn down the sound on your computer? There's a delay.
Yeah, if I do that, I can't hear you. Stephen, I want to ask you, you mentioned about Zen being ways, it turned out to be very parallel to Catholicism. And I was thinking of the book Eat, Pray, Love. And, yeah, I've got it down as low as I can without hearing you. Shall I try calling back again?
I'm okay, I can make it out.
I'm not quite hearing what's going on. I'm going to put you on hold for a second. It sounds like maybe you're calling from Skype or something. I'm not really sure. Maybe if you could just hit pause on the actual show if you're trying to talk with us through the computer, because there's definitely a delay, and I'm hearing you answer questions from a couple of minutes ago. So the caller is gone now. Hopefully he will call back with with his sound turned down or pause the show so that we don't hear the feedback. So it looks like Bobby Sissy has asked a question. She wants to know, in what ways is the Tibetan brand of Buddhism similar to Catholicism? It sounds like the same as the caller's question.
Well, it's similar only in the style, in the fact that, you see, Buddhism, the classical Buddhism, Theravadan Buddhism, also known as Southern Buddhism, which is what you find in Burma and or Myanmar and Sri Lanka and Thailand, is something very simple. It's extremely simple. And they work with the direct teachings of the Buddha as they were recorded from 2,500 years ago. And in those sutras, in those scriptures, the Buddha is presented as a man, very much a man, not a god, not somebody with magical powers, and not somebody teaching anything mystical or transworldly. He's talking about dealing with the reality of life in this world and how to live sanely. Now, when you go to the Tibetans, who are part of the northern school of Buddhism, and they've developed the Mahayana tradition, which is much more complex. And the Mahayana sutras or scriptures, they claim, were written or they were spoken by the Buddha at the same time that he was teaching the other scriptures down on earth. He was up in the Pure Lands and in heavens and different mystical places teaching the Mahayana sutras. And on top of that, there's another class of, or another vehicle of Buddhism, which they talk about, which is Tantra, which is extremely mystical and it's very secretive, and it's where all those fearsome-looking faces and gods come from, and there's lots of sex and brutality and anger involved, because the point of Tantra is to transform the negative emotions into aids on the path to awakening. So in that sense, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have a huge amount of belief in invisible spirits. In fact, there has been for the last 20 years, there's a great schism in the Tibetan tradition, especially among the Gelugpas, which is all about whether a certain invisible god called Dorje Shugden is on the side of good or on the side of evil. So these are the sort of debates that are going on, which to me really don't have much bearing on my life. And in fact, since I left the Tibetans, I spend most of my time practicing a much more austere form of Buddhism, which would be more like the Southern Buddhists.
Well, thank you so much for answering that question, and thank you, Bobby, for asking it. It looks like our caller is back, so maybe not. We're having some technical problems with that caller. I was going to bring him back up on the line. But, Bobby, does that answer your question? I'm just going to ask you in the chat room. And so, let's see. Why was it now you obviously left that, the Tibetan brand of Buddhism, but why did you leave Buddhism or the monastery behind?
Ah, yeah. Well, I left Tibetan Buddhism because all my teachers were there. And my intention was, because I'd studied for 8 years in some depth, I'd had some remarkable teachers, and I'm still incredibly grateful to them. But I'd learned a lot of stuff, and some of that stuff seemed to me extremely practical and valuable and useful, and other parts of it seemed to be very abstract, and I had no idea what use it might be or not be to me in my life. And I decided I was just going to go off and live an ordinary life, and I was going to let it all sink in and see what really made a difference and what didn't. It was a very difficult transition. It was much harder to leave the monastery than it is to go into it. But in time, after a few years, that question began to be answered. I started to see exactly the practices which were really helpful on a day-to-day basis in dealing with people, in dealing with work and the stresses of life. And that led me really much more down to a simpler, pared-down version of Buddhism. But by that time, I didn't really want to I didn't want to belong to an organization. I didn't feel it was necessary. I had my teachers. I'd internalized them in a certain sense. They mean a great deal to me, even though, in fact, they're all passed away now. And I have my own take, and I study the teachings of Buddha in great depth, and I teach it as well. But not as a Buddhist teacher. I teach it as a person who deals with the stresses of life and who's found some ways to make life easier and who's very interested in investigating the life of the Buddha and what he taught. And there are lots of people out there just like that. These are people who are not looking for religion, but they want some sort of spiritual life. And I'm that sort of person too. So it's a good match.
So it sounds, Stephen, like you were able to incorporate some of the most valuable Buddhist practices and teachings into your life, but you don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't consider yourself Buddhist anymore.
I don't call myself a Buddhist. In the privacy of my own mind, I do consider myself a Buddhist because the Buddha is the person that I go to with my questions, as it were. I know he's not here, but, you know, I go traveling through his scriptures in search of answers when I'm looking for a way to make sure I'm doing a practice properly or something. But ultimately, it's not about believing in some body or some system of beliefs. The practice of Buddhism, the practice that the Buddha taught, is to trust yourself and use your own mind and use your own inquiry and use your own empirical sense and your instincts of right and wrong to find your way. And so in that sense, I don't call myself a Buddhist because I'm not following anyone. I'm not following any organization. I'm not trying to belong to any organization. I'm trying to belong to myself. And that may sound narcissistic, but it's actually it's much harder than belonging to an organization. And it's much more precarious. But I feel that that's the way. That's certainly my way anyway.
No, it was beautifully said. I love that. And we're going to try the caller from area code 225 one more time. So hopefully he has the show on pause or volume turned down.
Well, I hope so. He sounded very enthusiastic.
Yeah. So from area code 225, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello. Hello.
Is the caller there? Oh, well, too bad. Okay, for trying. If you can pop into the chat room, feel free to ask your question as well. And I'm curious, actually, the other day, Bobby Sissi in the chat room has brought up the concept of following, and that's why she's not on Twitter, because she doesn't like following an organization. but speaking of Twitter, I was on Twitter the other day, and you know how they have people have groups. Or are you on Twitter, Stephen?
Well, I'm sort of signed up for it, but I don't use it that much. I'm not. No, I don't use it very much, I'm afraid.
Okay. well, there's. You can have people have groups of people that they'll put into a category to keep track of. And I was looking through some of the groups that I'm on, and there was one that came to me. It was really interesting. The guy had created this group of people who he said were Buddhists but didn't know it.
Yes, I'm sure that's a big group.
Yeah, because
of people I meet, yeah.
Some of the people that, you know, I guess some of the practices that they have and the beliefs they have. But I was kind of like a little bit, I didn't say anything, but I was a little taken aback because I didn't really appreciate him putting that label on me. I may have some beliefs that are in line with the Buddhist path, but I mean, what do you think of someone just characterizing, okay, well, you're Buddhist because you believe this?
Well, yeah, I'm sure I would be very annoyed if someone did that to me too. But on the other hand, I think the point he's trying to make is that what the Buddha taught was basically common sense. And I find that what I teach is common sense, and yet people come back to hear it. Now, why is that? It's because I think we all know how we would like to live, but we don't know how to actually put it into practice. We don't know how to make it a reality. And that sounds a little condescending, but it's not. It's very hard. I mean, it's to know that we have a bad habit is one thing. To change it is something quite different. And that's basically what the Buddha taught. He taught people how to live a sane life, relying on their own wits and their own intuition. And in that sense, it's common sense. And I think a lot of people do try to live that way. And some people succeed better than others, for sure.
So do you think, and of course this is just your opinion, just speculation, but do you think that the Buddha had intended it to be like a religion?
Oh, I don't think so, no. No. He saw it as a community. He himself was raised in pretty good circumstances. He wasn't a Brahmin, he was a Kshatriya, which is the warrior class or the warrior caste or the people who actually ran things and took care of the functioning of the state. And he didn't really have much time for the Brahmins. And he didn't have much time for the big airy-fairy questions like, is there a god or not? He was very, very, very careful to avoid getting involved in those sort of debates because he just thought it was a waste of time. He was not religious. He was anti-religious, quite clearly, to me anyway. And he went off. He left his home. He left his wealth behind. And he studied with a couple of teachers of the day. And he learned from them forms of meditation which take you into states of great bliss. And they're really forms of escape from reality. And he turned around and he left them as well. He said, well, that's no good either. I don't want to just sit in a state of bliss and do nothing. I want to be part of this life. I want to be here. But I want to be free of my own preconceptions and free of my own self-inflicted suffering. And I need to figure it out for myself. So that was the path he pursued, and he taught it for the rest of his life. And his dying words were, pursue the way with diligence. In other words, use your own wits. Keep your eyes open. And when they asked him to name a successor, someone else to lead the community, he said, no. He said, the teachings will be your leader. You pay attention to what you've learned and what you know and what you understand, and that will lead you. Use your own wits, basically. So, no, I think he was not religious. And I don't think he would have approved of what's followed any more than Christ would have approved of all the killing that goes on in his name. On the other hand, if there weren't these great big Buddhist institutions, if the Tibetan establishment wasn't as powerful as it is, there's a good chance I would never have gotten a chance to hear the teachings of the Buddha. They might not have existed after a couple of hundred years. So, you know, that's a paradox as well.
So it is interesting what you said. I was going to ask you about Jesus as well, because I'm sure Jesus Christ had no intention of Christianity or anything to the scale that it's at. I mean, he was just doing the same thing. He was just kind of teaching the way. And
yeah, maybe he was a Buddhist too.
Why do you think? Yeah, exactly. Why do you think that we as humans are so? I mean, we latch on to this teacher, and maybe it's going to come down to laziness again. I don't know, but we have this great teacher, Buddha or Jesus Christ or someone, and then it, rather than just having the teachings be the way, it becomes the person that is embodying this religion, and we turn it into this big thing. Why do you think we do that?
I think, Marie, that's fear. I think people come, there are basically two ways of taking or dealing or working with a religion. One is taking it as a challenge and as an adventure. And the other way is to take it as a consolation, as a sort of a security blanket. Because in either case, the reason we come to it is because we recognize that there's a deep insecurity inside us. So if you come to it with the idea of consolation and religion offering a security, then let's say, you know, I'm a Christian, and I believe in Jesus, and I believe that this is the only way to salvation, and I also subconsciously recognize how tenuous those beliefs are, and I'm afraid of losing them. And so I become more dogmatic, and I become more insistent that they're true. And it gets to the point where people start strapping explosives to their body and blowing themselves up because they're trying to convince themselves that if they believe hard enough, it really will be true. And people go nuts with belief. It's horrible. You know, the only way to respect a great idea or a great person who delivers a great idea is to take it with a pinch of salt. You can't just go swallowing everything wholemeal. It makes you sick. And it makes the world sick. It's very sad.
So, Stephen,
does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. And thank you so much. And when we talk, you mentioned belief. And if we believe it enough, if we believe it hard enough, it will. We hope that it will be true. So that brings me to my question about the law of attraction and The Secret. What have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't. No, tell me about it.
Okay. Well, have you heard of the law of attraction?
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, basically, the law of attraction is whatever you focus on, you attract. Whatever you surround yourself with, you attract, type of thing. And I believe, you know, I mean, I do believe that to an extent. But the Secret is basically a movie about how if you visualize and you imagine and you're just happy all the time, then all these happy things will happen to you. And if you imagine yourself riding a red sports car, you'll have a red sports car. And that's kind of what the movie's about. And I wanted to ask you about that, but you haven't seen it, so.
Well, I think I get the idea. It sounds like a perfect a perfect theory for consumerism. Would that be a good analogy?
Yeah, I think. Well,
it's all
I think
about
the
being
movie...
happy. I mean, when you turn on the TV and you look at the ads, what I see is a lot of people who are really happy. They're really happy because they've, you know, because they've gone to Staples to buy their printer, and they've gone to the right supermarket to buy their eggs, and they're all delightfully happy. This is the association of happiness with what we think we want. And that's exactly the way life works. It's true. When we focus on something, we tend to get what we're focusing on because that's what we go after. But what about the stuff that we don't get that might actually be what we need? I don't know. Maybe that's irrelevant. Maybe I'm missing the point of the, since I haven't seen the movie.
No, yeah. Well, I think, I mean, the movie is quite, it really is about getting external things, getting the relationship that you want, getting the car that you want. But I think, I mean, it does, if you look at it from a deeper perspective, it can, you know, the idea is basically to be happy in life and satisfied within yourself, not to be waiting and wishing and hoping for these external things, even though the movie kind of turns it around into sort of a catch-22 that you have to be happy in order to get these things, but you really want these things because it'll make you happy. But yeah, I just wanted to ask what your opinion is about that, but you haven't seen it. So it is, I like what you say about how maybe there are some things that we need that we don't get, and I'm wondering what are some of the things that you think we as a society really need the most that we're not getting right now?
Well, we need to stop. at least, you know, once in a while, we need to learn to stop. Smell the roses. Stop consuming. Stop putting our hopes in stuff or in certain events. And learning to sit and be. And especially learning to be able to sit for a minute without our minds filling with thoughts. I think that's really very important. I think if everybody did that every day, the world would be a completely different place.
Beautifully said. Well, and also, our person who had tried to call in is now in the chat room. So I'm going to relay this question now. He wanted to ask whether, as a former Catholic, you're familiar with the reasons Pierre Teilhard de Chardin gives for life's meaning. And he also wants to know your opinion about the Eat, Pray, Love movie. Have you read that book?
Yes, I've read the book.
Okay. And what he said, what you said about Zen, she ended up doing even stricter practices than when she was Catholic. And, okay, this is just a comment. In England, he was in England a few weeks ago, he asked the downside monk Sebastian Moore how he views death now that he is aging. His comment was, it's all about the now, which is a parallel to your own comments. So I guess, as a former Catholic, are you familiar with the reasons Pierre...
Yes, I already showed that. Yeah, I read him quite extensively a long time ago. I liked him as a relatively open Catholic. But I find him very complicated. Very complicated. And I find that's sort of typical of many of the great Christian thinkers. In order to make sense of it, they have to find a way to deal with the enormous amount of myth and the stories around the Bible and the stories around the meaning of Christ, because they don't want to step on too many toes. But I'm an admirer of Chardin, for sure.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for asking that question. And it looks like Bobby Sissy wants to call in as well. So I was going to ask you if we just have a couple minutes left in the show, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to add to close the show with.
Gosh, wow. Words of wisdom, I suppose, huh? I would really like to, maybe I should expand on that last little thing I said when you asked me what we really need to do, which is to stop. I would really love for people to stop for 1 minute each day, to stop thinking that getting the stuff that's advertised on TV is going to make them happy, or to stop thinking that a perfect relationship is going to make them happy, or to stop thinking that perfect health is going to make them happy. So that sort of happiness, people are not thinking in terms of real happiness. I think, on the whole, we tend to think in terms of temporal happiness. And that's something which happens in time, and so it comes to an end and it changes. It runs out. When you learn to stop, when you know how to be still, and you find it a comfortable place, then you don't have to feel good. Sometimes you'll be dealing with emotional issues. Sometimes you might be in physical pain. And yet there's a happiness that goes beyond that, or there's a sense of joy, just a sense of joy in the moment, in the act of existence itself, which transcends pleasure and pain. So I would ask people to look for a happiness which goes beyond pleasure. Happiness is not equivalent to pleasure. It's something much more profound.
That's so beautiful and so beautifully said. Thank you so much, Stephen. So again, your book is The Novice, Why I Became a Buddhist Monk, Why I Quit, and What I Learned. And your website is thenovice.ca, not .com, .ca.
Uh-huh.
And is that the best place for people to purchase your book? Because I have a link up to the Amazon as well.
Yeah, you can go there. Well, that page will link you to Amazon as well. And you can, it links to the Canadian Amazon and the US and the UK. You can buy it in any of those. You can get it in the bookstores as well. Or if you want a signed copy, you can order it on the website, and I will sign it and dedicate it to you and mail it out myself.
Oh, wonderful. That's nice. So, again, it's www.thenovice.ca, and I will add that link to the show page as well in case you're listening on podcast or want to hear the show again. Well, thank you so much, Stephen. It's been such a pleasure and such a fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much, Marie. It was a great pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone who tried to call in and to the questions in the chat room. Have a wonderful day. Be well. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, so our show is now airing 1 p.m. Pacific time. If you are listening to this on podcast, please tune in live, 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time. Again, the name of our guest today was Stephen Scatini, and his website is thenovice.ca. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for all your calls and your messages in the chat room. I hope that you have a wonderful day, and remember to be still and enjoy this moment. Take care. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.